welcome one and all to the one and only, quite literally only, Aftershock podcast, the Aftershock Central podcast with Martin and Travis. Was that different enough?
No.
No? It's still pretty much the same, right?
Yeah, no, it needs work.
Yeah, it needs a lot of work. I'm trying to change the intro, but I'm failing. So, my apologies.
Oh, maybe we can get some listener suggestions.
Oh, perfect. If you want to suggest a new script for our introduction, then let us know on Twitter at Rumbar316. Ronnie's busy, so he's out. He's still at work. I just got home from work. But you know what? The show must go on, Travis. You know what I mean?
We
troop. Yeah, you just got home too. We're trooping.
Trooping, yeah.
Super trooping.
Yeah, so what's this? 4 weeks in a row? 3 weeks in a row?
Sure. I don't know, since I came back.
we're back in form.
Yeah, there you go. I don't know what form that is. Form of a bucket, shape of water. Oh, wait, wrong podcast. That'd be a DC podcast. Yes, hello, welcome, one and all.
Are we the Wonder Twins?
Yes, we're the Wonder Twins. Unite.
Ooh.
Episode title. See, we found it.
Yes.
We have gathered here tonight to discuss two books. We will be talking about the only new release from this week, which is Orphan Age number 5. But we will also be discussing Shock Volume 2, because the book came out 2 months ago. So it's time we talk about it.
It's long, dude.
It is very long.
It takes a while to digest, but that's a good thing.
Yes, it's, like 150 pages. It's a lot.
It's awesome, dude.
It's great. Spoiler alert. We can't spoil that yet. Let's kick things off discussing this week's new book, and that is Orphan Age number 5. This is maybe the final issue. Written by Ted Anderson, with art by Nuno Plotty, colors by Joe Lemos and Nuno Plotty, letters by Marshall Dillon. So you and I briefly powwowed before this episode about this issue, because I had some questions, which you very nicely answered for me. Because for some reason, apparently, I had forgotten what happened in issue 4, and so I was kind of taken a little by surprise from what I remembered where the story left off to where this issue starts, about how we saw Cozy in Albany. But I think you answered that pretty well, right? Because the previous issue kind of ends with them showing up in Albany and meeting, what's her name? Lindy?
Mm-hmm.
Meeting Lindy in the council, so thank you, Travis. I'm glad that somebody pays attention on the show.
Well, dude, I totally understand. When you go on vacation for a month, you know, like, sometimes you can't remember what came the month before, so.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, so I'm here to help.
Well, I appreciate it. So let's discuss this issue. Where do you want to start the discussion? Because I was going to go right to the end, but we can't go to the end. We have to start somewhere else.
Okay. I mean, like, where I would start with this, like, what I think is central to this issue, is, you know, like, basically they have the meeting to discuss this, and, you know, as I had expected, they kind of are like, all right, well, like, this is a siege, you know, and Lindy is basically prepared to, you know, wait it out indefinitely, you know, like, it's kind of the conservative play.
Mm-hmm.
And she, like, she talks everybody into that with, like, a pep talk, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, like, you know, she then admits, like, as an aside, that basically she feels like an imposter, you know, like, that she thinks they're all, like, kids that are, like, posing as adults, which ties into the premise, and, like, they're not being, like, the older generation there, so, like, basically they've all taught themselves with books and, like, vague knowledge of the past. But, you know, it's like, I thought that was interesting as an aside.
No, I don't think that's an aside, to be honest. I think that might be the central thing in this book that I found interesting. Because you're right. And I think that's something that's been... It's been kind of played around with throughout the series, right? But I think this is the first time it seems blatantly obvious that that's what they're doing. And I think Lindy said some interesting things on there, in particular relating to the church, because she was talking about how, you know, they set this place up and they've basically, like, tried to recreate the world that their parents left behind, but they have no idea how to do it. Right, so that's kind of where the imposter syndrome comes in. They don't know how to do it because when this apocalypse happened, they were all children, and so none of them are educated, right? Like, they weren't trained to be soldiers, they're not trained to be governors or diplomats or anything like that. They're just kids trying to fake it based on kind of maybe what they remember from TV shows and movies, to be honest with you, is what I think. Because as kids, like, what other way would they have been exposed to any of this stuff if not from TVs and movies? Or comic books, YouTube, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, as far as all that stuff existing before this happened, you know? Because as soon as you lose electricity, you lose all of that electric media, you lose the internet, so at that point, basically you're constructing it from hard copy, mm-hmm. you know? And yeah, there's probably not a lot of older kids around who really had a sophistication in any subject that you would need to, build a society.
Well, and if I remember correctly, Princess's dad seemed a little bit older, right? Or was that just me? Maybe just the way that he acted seemed older. Because Princess is what, 9, 10?
Maybe.
Maybe? So, I mean, yeah, I guess he'd still be pretty young. Mid-20s to early 30s, tops. Yeah, I don't know. This is really, not related to the book because it never happens. But don't you think that, there's some nerdy kid somewhere that, had a backup of Wikipedia on, a TI-83, solar calculator? You know what I mean? And, he's just... He's got an empire because he can access Wikipedia and nobody else can. You know that's got to be happening in this world, right? Maybe it's just me. Maybe that's what I would do.
Are you implying that Wikipedia can fit on a graphing calculator? Because if so, why do they hit me up for money every month?
I actually have downloaded a copy of Wikipedia on a Raspberry Pi, which is powered by a battery that's a rechargeable battery that's hooked up to a solar panel. So in the event that for some reason I don't have power for days or months or let's say, 20 years, I can access Wikipedia. So I would be that guy. But I'm just saying, there's got to be, Martin is in this book somewhere in this world, right? And he's ruling an empire off of his offline copy of Wikipedia.
Martin, I love you, but I think you messed up big time, man. Because now, when the apocalypse happens, all of our listeners know exactly where they can get. That's a pretty cushy setup.
Good luck finding me. Good luck finding me. That's all I'm saying. I don't know if you do. You still watch Walking Dead?
I never watched The Walking Dead.
Oh, you never watched it? Okay, so I quit watching it a couple years ago, and for some reason, a couple months back, I decided to get caught up, and because the seasons are on Netflix. And there was a character that shows up, this older woman, and she's like, she wants to trade knowledge for like vinyl records, I think it was. I can't remember exactly. But apparently, like, when the S started hitting the fan, she, I mean, it's not offline copies of Wikipedia, but like she wrote down all these like manuals for like, you know, like bridge building techniques and like certain like simple machinery and whatever, that they could use to like restart the new world. And you know, 5 issues, maybe not enough. And from what we heard at the panel at, C2E2, I think Ted maybe wanted this to be a much longer story. Cause it seems like there's gotta be something like that in this world. And it just kind of popped into my head with the whole thing with Princess, because we never really know what the ultimate plan is, right? But Princess tells Lindy what the plan is, right? Like, she and her dad had this whole plan set up, and Albany was not the final destination. It was just like a halfway point to get to where they, where she was really supposed to go. And unless I missed it, like, we don't know what that is.
Yeah, I mean, I was gonna get to that, because I mean, that's what I think is like most interesting about this issue, is like that, you know, they've got this plan, and like, to your point, I think it may only be like the first stop, you know, like I kind of got the idea that basically this plan is like to go to like every city one by one and organize them somehow. Mm-hmm. You know, like they're doing something. But, you know, like I was struck by that, you know, this idea was so compelling. She gets Lindy into a room and tells it to her, and she instantly changes the plan to like a thing she previously said was impossible. So, you know, like, I want to know what the plan is.
Right.
You know? And like, I don't know, like, I understand definitely, like, you know, to the extent that you want to tell a big story, you know, like you want to be able to tell that story in like a long format. But I don't know, if you know you're only going to get 5 or 6 issues, and then maybe more if it does well, like, I feel like you maybe have to give a little bit more. Like holding stuff back is tough.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, like, I don't know, like, you kind of have to give people a reason to want to buy more.
Yes. Yeah, I feel like... Here's the thing. I brought this up before we started recording, so I'll bring it up again. I don't know if this book is over or not. Because the way that it ends, it kind of ends in the middle of the action, right? So Lindy and the council set up this plan where they're basically going to start mortaring all the church snipers and, you know, backup units or whatever in the woods, and just let all the people that want to leave Albany just, like, run as fast as they can, and hopefully, like, some of them will make it to where they want to go. And the book kind of ends there, right? Like, there's mortar shells flying everywhere, there's people running, there's people on horses, there's people in cars, and we kind of end in a poem, which kind of, I mean, we've seen that in a lot of these issues, right, where Ted uses some kind of poem or a verse from something to kind of end the issue. But the issue, when the poem ends, the issue ends, and there's no, you know, to be continued, volume 2 coming soon, the end, like, there's none of that. It just ends in the poem. And I don't know if maybe that's an oversight from editorial, or if it's on purpose, Or if the book is just maybe on hiatus for a couple of months. Because I like I told you, I looked at solicits for September, October, and it's not listed. So if an issue 6 is coming, it's not in the next couple months.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. If there was a question of, like, is it going to continue? I don't know. You know, like, I don't necessarily mind, like, the occasions where an Aftershock book has done an arc and then the end has some kind of, like, hey, if you want more, like, get people to buy the trade and stuff, you know? Like, make it clear that that's the situation if it is, you know? Yeah, I mean, because I am interested where this was going, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, if it is still continuing, I'm happy for that. But, you know, that would be a pretty key oversight as far as accidentally leaving out the end or to be continued, etc.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I mean, I could see this being an ending, right? Based on some of the themes that we discussed for this issue about kids basically cosplaying as adults. I could see that because it fits the theme and it fits the verse that is used to end the story. But it also doesn't answer some of the big stuff that showed up in this issue, like the plan that Princess gives Lindy. Like, I would have much rather either spend 2 panels on it, and it's a stupid plan, but at least we know what the plan is, than us never knowing what it is. And right now, I mean, I want to assume that we're never going to know what it is because the book doesn't tell me that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't get why if this is the end, like, for now, you wouldn't say, like, the end for now or, like, the end volume 1 so that people would, you know, like, you invite people asking, like, when's volume 2, you know, like... I get if it's a situation where they don't know if there's going to be more, but I don't know. It's the most mysterious way to address that.
Yes. I agree. I'm looking over to make sure I didn't miss it. Nope, I certainly did not miss it. Just making sure. Yes, it's kind of weird, but I would like to see that. And what's interesting too is some of the stuff that's set up, right? Like there's definitely a lot of setup for a volume 2. So I'm very hopeful because I would love to see more of this story. I think the world's really interesting. And I think in the 5 issues that we've gotten, it's like barely hitting the surface of where this story could go. You know, we talked about the stuff in Albany with Lindy, what she said. The one thing that we didn't discuss is what she says about the church, right? Because, like, they don't know if the church has been planning the siege all along or not. It seems like maybe they could have. But what's really interesting about it is that she says that what they're building is something new, right? Like, every other town in this world is basically just redoing what they saw their parents do. And what the kids in the church are doing is something completely new. They're not hindered by anything that came before it. And that's really curious. And I want to see that explored as well.
Yeah. I mean, I thought that was interesting, but I was definitely curious about what they are doing. Cause it, you know, like, we don't really have insight aside from what we've seen, which is just like, I'm pretty sure that, you know, like raiding and pillaging, et cetera, is not a original concept.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, there must have been people in the post-apocalypse or whatever that we're doing that, but there's something about the organization of the church, I guess, that is original. So if it came back, that would be interesting, you know, like if somehow you could split the time, like one of the characters gets captured or something and goes into the church, but they're alive and you see what's going on there. Like mm-hmm. that'd be interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of places that you can go, but like, look, you can't do The Walking Dead at Aftershock, you know, like
that's true.
You know, like prove me wrong. Like when they get to issue like 192 of, Orphanage, but, you know, that's like you gotta kind of get to the point with Aftershock stuff.
Yes, agreed. All right, you want to rate it up?
Yeah, I will go 3.75 out of 5.
I think we're in agreement today, Travis. I don't like the decimal place thing. You know that.
I know.
But I feel like 3 is too low and 4 is too high. In fact, my original score was going to be a 3 out of 5. But after this discussion, I've decided to increase my score. Because I think we really hit on what made this issue really interesting, is some of those themes. So, 3.75 out of 5. Very good, Travis. Very good. I'm proud of us.
Yeah. What about fractions? Are you okay with fractions?
Fractions. No, I think I prefer I prefer decimals.
Okay.
Yes. What are those called? Rational numbers? I like rational numbers. I don't know.
Yeah, because you're such an irrational person.
I was gonna say I kind of like irrational numbers too. I can't rate it pi. Pi's too low a score.
Root 2?
Yes, root 2.
Root 2 is pretty rough. How about root 11?
Ooh, very good. All right. That's it for Orphanage. Let's move on. We're going to move on to Shock Volume 2. And obviously, we're not going to discuss every single story in this because how many are there? Like 15 different stories, I think? 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18 stories. Yeah, definitely can't do that on this show. But we're going to do 3 or 4, maybe 5. How's that sound?
Yeah, a grab bag.
A grab bag, a smorgasbord.
A handful of
stories. Very good. Let's do that. You want to kick off with The Vampiress?
Sure thing.
All right. So Vampiress is written by Marguerite Bennett with art by Zachariah Roan. We have Patricia Camino on colors and Marshall Dillon on letters. This was very interesting.
Yeah, dude. It definitely kind of like takes a turn that I wasn't expecting.
Yeah, I started reading it and I was like, "Where is this going?" Because the setup is really—it's very Marguerite, by the way. Like both the setup and the narration choice and the dark turn is very Marguerite. So if you're a fan of Marguerite, you'll definitely like the story. But go ahead, Travis.
Okay, so here, my reading of this story is like basically, you know, I think it's kind of like a trope inversion, if you will, where, you know, like the vampirist is, you know, like turns out to be the good guy. And, you know, the like witch hunter guy turns out to be the villain, you know,
yeah.
Like. And you start out the issue with the idea, basically, that, like, yeah, she's a vampire, but all of her, like, meals or whatever, whatever we're calling them, they consent.
You know?
Like, like, basically, they're all in love with her, you know? And there's kind of an interesting, like, discussion of, like, the different types, you know? Like, the total prudes and the hypocrites and, you know, basically, like, the people that are totally down, you know?
Yeah.
Like, so that was interesting. But, like, they all consent, but you get, to a point where, you know, like, the witch hunting has, or the vampire hunting is bad for business, and it's scaring everybody away, and so she's driven in desperation to try and feast on a child.
Yes. Because she needs
virgin blood.
So, yes. Because originally I thought maybe Blood of the Innocent, but I think one of her lovers was a Catholic priest, right?
Yeah.
Okay, just making sure I got that right. Yeah, continue.
Yeah, so, like, she feeds on the child and that, or, like, whatever, tastes it and says, like, this child's not a virgin, you right. know? And it's like, tell me who, you know? And, like, surprise, it's church guy, and he doesn't have a good time.
He does not have a good time. He gets strung up in a church by his intestines, I think.
Yeah. I mean, so, like, I mean, I think that is interesting, like, because, you know, like, obviously he didn't care about consent, you know? Like, I think that that's a kind of some, like, piece of the, like, the thematic stuff in this story, you know?
Yeah, I think thematically there's a lot, right? So I think for one, there's definitely commentary on, like, hypocrisy in religion, right? For sure. Mm-hmm. We get that from the priest, right? Because she's talking about how, like, even the reluctant ones, and that's when they show the priest, and then, of course, the witch hunter guy, because they're what? They're, like, going out and, like, killing animals and then, like, scaring people away and, like, you know, burning people for being – well, they don't show a burning, but, like, hunting people for being witches or whatever. And he's doing it all in the name of the church. But at the same time, like, he's raping this little girl. So I think there's definitely commentary on that. Obviously, there's commentary on just sexuality in general, right? And I think that's kind of where the consent thing comes in. Because even though she's a vampire, like, she's not hurting anybody, right? She's picking people that want to do this with her. And I think that's important. Whether people agree with the choices or not, maybe a different story, right? Because she's got a female lover, she's got a male lover, well, she's got two male lovers. And so obviously she doesn't really care about that. It's just about the love aspect, the sensuality of the whole vampire, the donor, I guess, relationship. And I don't know if you've ever seen, like, documentaries on people that think they're vampires, but the whole psychology of it is really interesting. And obviously, like, they're not real vampires. But I would assume that, like, were vampires to actually exist, maybe it would be somewhat similar to that. A lot of it is very sexual and sensual. So, you know, whatever floats your boat, right? And I think maybe that's what Marguerite's saying. Like, if you want to be with a woman, be with a woman. You want to be with a guy, be with a guy. Like, as long as you care about each other, you're doing it consensually, you're not hurting anybody, like, what's the problem? I think there's some of that in here as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would just add to that that, you know, it's definitely, I think, a trope as far as equating vampirism with, you know, like, sex.
Yeah.
Essentially. Yeah. You know? Like even back to Dracula and whatever is like basically that's my understanding is it's you know, it's a metaphor for sexual awakening or whatever, you know? So, you know, definitely make sense, you know, that that is explored here, you know, mm-hmm. like vampirism and sex,
yes.
you know.
Yeah, I agree. It's very interesting. I like the turn, and it was definitely unexpected. And there's a lot of story told in, what, like, 4 pages, 5 pages?
Yeah, it's well done, dude, which is not a surprise because Marguerite is a beast.
Beast is a compliment for
all It is a compliment, yeah.
For all you old people. yeah, for sure, for sure. I think this was definitely one of the more interesting stories of the whole bunch. And there were a lot of really good ones in this second volume. And now I want to get some thoughts comparing this to volume one, but we'll save that till the end. Let's see. Let's talk about Pestilence.
Cool.
So I obviously really enjoyed that book. I think we all did, actually. But I'm a sucker for zombie stuff. And this story was fascinating because there are a gazillion zombie flicks and books and whatever. But I think Frank did something really interesting with the structure of the story. So writer Frank Thierry, we have art by Oleg Okunev, colors by DC Alonso, and letters by Marshall Dillon. And this one, like, centers on one of the zombies. And you see him and his whole zombie horde, like, attacking animals and attacking people. But he's got, like, an inner monologue going on where he realizes what he's doing, but he has no control over it. And I thought that whole aspect was really interesting and kind of refreshing. I've seen this done in movies, like, once, I think. And I can't remember what movie it was. But then, like, oh, God, what was that one called? Was it Empire of the Dead? Can't remember. But one of the Romero flicks actually has, like, a smart zombie that kind of leads the zombies on a revolt against humanity. And he can't talk, but he's very aware of what he's doing. And he even, like, figures out how to use, like, a machine gun at one point. God, what was the name of that movie? I wish I remembered.
I think it's called Land of the Dead.
Land of the Dead, that's it. Land of the Empire's not hasn't been made yet. Yeah, and that whole aspect is interesting, but I think the inner monologue added a little something to it. Maybe, is it Fido? God, I wish I remembered. It's not Fido. There's one where, like, a zombie guy falls in love with this girl. And...
Warm, like, Bodies?
Warm Bodies. Is that it? That might be it. Because that one's got,
like,
the inner monologue,
like a
right?
Zombie rom-com? I've never seen it.
I'll have to rewatch it. That might be it. That might be it. But it's cool, right?
It's fascinating, dude. And I, yeah, like, I've obviously I've never seen whatever you're referencing, so this was a wholly novel idea to me as far as, like, POV from, you know, a zombie.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, to your point, kind of, like, the only way you could do this in a movie is if you do voiceover, you know? Which is, you know, like, generally avoided in cinema.
Yes.
You know, so, like, it really does, though, lend itself to the comic book medium.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, I think, you know, kind of interestingly to your point about, like, Land of the Dead, I feel like there's certain things in this that maybe suggest that, like, they're not all like this. You know,
yes.
But how could you know if you're not talking to them? But, like, the guy seems to think, this zombie, that, like, he maybe is like has more faculties than the other ones, even though they could just be in exactly the same boat where they're like trapped in a body they can't control or whatever. Like they're in control, but they are also in the grips of an uncontrollable urge that makes them do this stuff.
Yeah. I wonder if they would have enough faculties to, if there were another zombie like him, would they be able to communicate that? Or would their base instincts override any of that communication?
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing that you see that suggests that, like, once the food is gone in a given place, that they wouldn't be like, maybe I should say something.
Sure, yeah.
Just be like, anybody know where there's food? No.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, it would be a real problem if they all were just waiting, like, they didn't want to be the first ones to speak up, you know?
That it's curious. And, I mean, obviously we can only speculate because there's only so much that we see of it until he gets killed, right, by the Lux.
Yes.
Which I love that the way that it ended as well, right? Like, number one, it was very Frank Thierry. But number two, like, it plays on the trope, right? Because it's a zombie, right? Like, why would you say that, hey, like, maybe the zombie's, like, thinking about something? It's a freaking zombie. So, of course, it's not thinking about anything, right? All it's thinking about is eating people. So I think it played really well thematically with the rest of the story and with zombie tropes.
Well, dude, this is Love Child Zombie, dude. I was struck by that as well. The part that was like, okay, but like, yeah, I'm a zombie, but I can work within the system to like teach these other zombies that like, they don't have to eat people or whatever, you know? Like,
yeah.
Like, I'm going to do chains from within the system, which, like, cuts deep, maybe just generally for me, like how easy it is to lampoon that idea of, like, oh, but you have to, like, change things within the system, and you're definitely not going to be corrupted within the system.
Mm-hmm.
Like, once you're in the system, you're going to do what you say.
Right.
You want to do. Yeah. So I don't know if that speaks to a larger thematic thing there, like as just a takedown of the like work within the system trope. But if so, like, ouch, dude, that cuts real deep, as do a lot of good zombie narratives, you know?
Yes.
The really good ones put it up against a backdrop thematically or whatever that you're like, this is what this is about, you know? It's about consumerism or war or racism or whatever.
Exactly. There's thousands probably of zombie movies, and I'm pretty sure I've seen them all. Matter of fact, I didn't see it, but I found one that I've never seen, and it was fairly recent. I wish I remember what it was. Anyways, but I'm pretty sure outside of that, I've seen them all. But you're right. Like, I think sometimes the problem with zombie stuff is, there's so much garbage. Cause it's, like, it's really easy to do a garbage zombie movie, right? Just make it like a monster flick. I think that's why maybe like the Romero films for the most part end up doing so well for fans of that genre, or like, 28 Days Later, for example, or, what's that really good one? The Returned. All those movies try to do very different things with the genre, right? And they usually come up when, like, everyone plays on the same trope, so everyone's like, ugh, I'm so tired of zombies. But then, like, here comes this new thing, like 28 Days Later. You're like, huh, well, I guess zombies can run really fast. Like, that's new. How does that change the dynamic? You know, or The Return, where, like, zombies get cured and they're not zombies anymore. But, like, how do people treat them when they're trying to reintegrate in society? Like, there's cool things you can do. You just gotta have some imagination. But yeah, I think when you play upon the socio-political aspects of things, is when the zombie stuff can be interesting. Or, you know, like Walking Dead, you know, the show's fine. But like the comic, what makes it good is one of the things that I like, and I'm not a Walking Dead comic fan per se, but, you know, it plays upon the, like, how does this affect humans? Right? Because the Walking Dead aren't the zombies. The Walking Dead are the people left over after the apocalypse. So all that stuff is interesting. And I think this plays a lot upon that. And I thought that was cool. Done in a very Frank Thierry way. So that's always fun. Cause, I don't think Frank gives two S's about anything. So it's pretty awesome to see in a book.
Yeah, and also just as a backdrop for the Pestilence series.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Like, it's fascinating, man.
Well, and it gives something new to think about, right? Like, what if every single zombie is having this inner monologue? Right? Like, that almost makes things a little more gruesome if, like, people's minds are trapped in this state. Right? Like, can you imagine witnessing yourself do, like, eating people or whatever? Like, how would you react to that? And you couldn't do anything about it.
Yeah, I mean, because you're actively participating.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, and, like, that points to, you know, kind of the conclusion of at least the first arc. I forget how the second arc concluded, but, I mean, obviously the first arc, you know, like, they're, like, bathed in, like, the holy water rain, and all of these zombies, like, turn back to normal,
mm-hmm.
you know, for the most part. So, yeah, like, that, I think, does point to maybe that's what's going on here, you know, just in general. But, you know, like, when these guys are surrounded by hordes of zombies, and, like, they're trying to, you know, like, save the day, defeat evil, like, you're gonna have to do something about the immediate threat, you know? Like, if you let them kill you because, like, deep down they're human, then, like, the zombies win.
Mm-hmm. Yep. For sure.
Or whatever is fueling them, because that much is still kind of somewhat unclear, you know? Like, mm-hmm. It's a devil, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. All right, which one do you want to do next?
You want to do Man, I'm Evil, Dude?
Yeah, Man, I'm Evil, Dude. Written by Cullen Bunn, with art by Jamal Eagle. We have colors by Guy Major and letters by Marshall Dillon. So what did you like about this one?
Dude, I mean, I think it's interesting. You know, like, obviously, I have to assume it's saying something about the nature of evil, you know? But, like, basically my reading of it is, like, dude kind of finds himself unknowingly in what appears to be, like, a job interview working for the devil, maybe.
Yes, maybe.
You know? Like,
seems likely.
Or something thereabouts.
Yeah.
You know? And he's, like, a poser for all intents and purposes, you know? Like, as a kid, he, like, tortured a dog or something. He's like, oh, yeah, well, like, I'm evil, you know? And, you know, it's really this other guy, let's call him the devil, who instigates him to be like, yeah, but prove it, though, because, like, how about this guy? He, you know, it's like, he's across the way, and he's got a daughter, and, you know, like, what would you do to him, you know? And, like, the dude doesn't even do it seemingly by, like, intent, you right. know? Like, he tries to wriggle out of it, but kind of does a race dance, like something pops into his head. And Devil Dude is like, oh, that's perfect. You got the job, you know? Like, so, like, I don't know. That, like, that piece of it, I think, is fascinating that, like, you know, Dude, at least in this instance, couldn't control this thing, you know? And, like, I think I understand that. Like, it's certainly probably a pretty common experience to kind of have, like, stuff pop into your head where you're like, where did that come from? Or what, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, or, like, to have, like, dark thoughts about something happening to yourself or others that you, like, aren't in control of, but especially if you have somebody that's trying to prompt it in your head, that's something to put, like, jump in.
Right. Yeah, it was interesting. And maybe, like, something will come out of it, right? Because it ends with the beginning. So maybe this is something that Colin's got going on in his head. So I would love to see how it develops. It gave me some vibes. What's that that manga? My brother's going to kill me if I get this wrong. Is it Death Note? The one where the guy, like, writes in a book and whatever he writes for people, like, actually happens to him. So basically he starts writing in this book, like, terrible ways of killing people. And this, like, Japanese demon thing actually kills him in the way that he writes in the book. I think that's how it goes. If I got that wrong, I apologize. I'm not a manga guy. I mean, I read it sometimes.
I think that is Death Note.
Yeah. That's how it goes, right? He writes in the book and then the demon kills the people. Anyways, somebody correct me. I hope my brother's not listening because he is going to kill me if I got that wrong. So
he's going to imagine a scenario for you that is very unpleasant.
Yes, he's going to write me into his death notebook. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it's got vibes of that. So I thought that was cool. I'm not sure, like, what exactly he thought, right? Because it seems like maybe the girls just become, like, a giant cancer or something, right? Is that what you got out of it? Just like a giant tumor?
Something like that, yeah. I just thought that, like, maybe he had this kind of giant monster tumor or something.
Well, there's that one panel where, like, the dad is, like, flung out of the room by the tumor. So that's why I assume, like, the kids were, like, his daughters were turned into giant tumors or whatever. And, like, I don't know why anyone would think that. Like, oh, what bad thing would you do to them? I would turn them into giant cancer. That doesn't seem very evil, so it kind of goes with the story a little bit as well. That was cool. It was awesome. I thought the art was great. A little body horror in there, so that's always fun. I like that kind of stuff. And we'll see where it goes. I do hope that there's some kind of follow up to it in some way.
It's definitely a cool idea, and, you know, like, Cullen discussed it on episode 101, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
For if anybody wants to go back as far as, like, the origins of it. I am interested as well. You know, like, I definitely, you know, like, if there was something more to come from this, you know, like, if you love the idea, I'd be interested to see where it goes. I'm curious about if it's, you know, trying to say something about the nature of evil, you know, like, because obviously there's this idea of, like the banality of evil or something, whereas, like, people aren't, like, evil per se, but they just let evil things happen, or, you know, like, you know, like, and I guess I'm interested how that intersects with the idea that, like, why is this devil thing need for a random person to be doing this, like, work, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like he does that say something about, like, lacking the evil, lacking, like, imagination or something, you know?
Mm.
Like, somebody else maybe it comes from like personal horror or something. The idea of like, what would I be like horrified and like revulsed by is like, if this thing happened, and you know, like that's something that a non-human couldn't understand, or like they couldn't create that.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, that could be interesting thematically. If that is the case, I'd be interested to discuss that. Because I have some odd ideas about evil, so it could be interesting to discuss. You mentioned it being Satan. You know what I just thought about? It'd be a lot cooler, since it's Cullen Bunn, if it were not Satan, but like an elder god. Because Cullen loves Cthulhu, and or you know, like that whole mythology. So I think that'd be kind of cool. I just saw a movie a couple days ago called Black Sight. It was not the greatest movie. In fact, it was not like great at all. But it kind of plays a little bit with this. It's kind of weird. It's like sort of Men in Blackish, but with elder gods. Like there's this agency that traps elder gods and like deports them to another dimension. But of course, like the elder gods have people that follow them and you know, whatever. I don't want to spoil the movie, even though no one's going to see it. But if it was an elder god, I think it'd be cool, and I think it would work thematically better here than it would with Satan. Because I think like if it was the devil, don't you think that like we've seen that kind of thing before? Like, yeah, the devil maybe do bad things. Like, it's Cullen, so he can make it work. But I think it'd be more interesting for me, at least, if it was some other kind of evil entity.
I certainly agree that that is a super interesting idea. If it was an elder god or some other kind of mythology that's feeding it. Mm-hmm. If it were the devil, that speaks to a different idea that I had, actually, which was like, what if this is, you know, this guy's hell, or the hell for like any like tool poser teenager or whatever that like tortures animals or whatever, like to seem whatever dark, whatever superficial reasons somebody would have for doing that stuff or whatever. But the idea that it's like, this guy's punishment is actually creating like horrific evil stuff that happens to real people, and like it happens over and over and over again. You know, like, so if that's what it was, I think that also would be an interesting idea.
Yeah, I like it. Let's see, you picked that one, so I guess I'll pick another one. Ronnie's not here. So let's talk about The Playground. This is written by Joe Pruitt with art by Simon Kudransky and letters by Marshall Dillon. By the way, I love that it was in black and white. I think it fit that thematically very well. The story is really interesting. We should discuss possible ties to Black Eyed Kids. But basically, it's a dad that goes to this playground, and there's a little girl there, and they start talking, and she's like, yeah, I remember you. And he's like, you can't remember me. You're 12. This happened like 30 years ago. And that's when things take a dark turn. You learn that this guy killed his son and apparently a bunch of kids and buried them in this playground and then escaped. Went to what, Kentucky, I think he said. And now he's back to, I guess, maybe get an apology from his dead kid who can't really apologize. Except he can. And he does not accept the apology. It was very interesting, I thought. And really well done for as short a story as it was. And I do wish that Joe would write more, because I think Joe's a fantastic writer. I wish he'd find some kind of book to put out that would really hit a nerve with a particular audience. And I mean, obviously Black Eyed Kids hit a nerve with all of us. We really enjoyed it. But overall it didn't do as well in the market as maybe it deserved. So I would like to see Joe return with something else. And the thing that was different about this one compared to Black Eyed Kids, for example, is how much darker this was. And like maybe the dad going back and trying to get redemption was a little tropey, but I thought it was executed extremely well. And of course, having the artist from Black Eyed Kids, Ronnie mentioned in our private message that it immediately reminded him of Black Eyed Kids. Even Billy reminded him of the boy King from Black Eyed Kids. So you want to talk about that connection a little bit? Or you know what? Give me some thoughts on the story first before we get to that.
Okay, well, I mean, my thoughts would be that I definitely agree that it was, you know, well executed, especially in the context of, you know, being a short story in an anthology. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to your point, like, yeah, like, Joe's awesome, and he comes from an anthology background.
Right.
So this is his wheelhouse. Mm-hmm. I as far as I know. And I would also just make a brief nod to the idea that it's not that easy, you know? Like I read a collection of stories that Alejandro Jodorowsky wrote.
Yeah.
As a companion to pieces that he wrote for Metal Hurlant when that came back like a decade ago or something, you know? And the substance of it is like basically it's just a direct quote of him to another author that was saying, I apologize for the length of like this letter, you know, it would have taken me too long to write a shorter one.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's just an idea that like to really do this stuff effectively, it is like, there's a lot going on behind the scenes, you know, like it's a very specific skill, and you have to set up something and finish it like within a very short amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
So I like, I'll just tip my hat to that.
Yeah. It's very hard to do very short self-contained stories, that can tell a full story in this short amount of time. Right. I mean, you have what? 15, 20 panels to tell your story. That's very tough. But yeah, I think in terms of accomplishing that, this was definitely one of the better stories. Again, not to demean from any of the other ones, but I think playing with the format, it did it extremely well. All right, so let's talk about the Black Eyed Kids connection.
Okay.
Ronnie brought it up. He's not here. So let's discuss. Give me some thoughts. Do you think the playground is connected to the Black Eyed Kids?
I mean, when I read that story, I was very struck by, especially in a couple panels, I was like, that looks like the boy King,
right?
You know? Like, I don't know how there's any way you could see that and not be reminded of that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's a wink or whatever, you know?
Yeah, it could be. And, you know, having the same artist, it could just be a stylistic thing also.
Yeah, like a coincidence.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But, like, I mean, isn't the Boy King supposed to be hundreds of years old?
I mean, the spirit inside him could be. But obviously the body is not.
Well, I mean, isn't the idea that they don't age once they become black-eyed kids or whatever?
Yes, but if you remember in Black-Eyed Kids, we did kind of see part of the ceremony where the kids were in this pool and came out as black-eyed kids. Right? So it could be that process that, like, enchants them or binds them to this demonic spirit or whatever. I don't think that was really delved very deeply in the story itself, like the actual origins of the black-eyed kids. But if I remember correctly, that was the case.
But each black-eyed kid is like a different entity, right?
Yes.
And you think that they jump bodies?
I think maybe through this ritual they can jump bodies. I don't know. The thing to me that connected the playground to black-eyed kids, and again, if Joe's listening, I'm sure he can tell us, but was when he was talking about after he killed the kids, how he went to Kentucky and joined this cult, and there were a bunch of kids there, and he didn't feel comfortable with it, so he left. That's kind of what struck me as maybe being some kind of tie to that story.
Hmm. Yeah, I forgot about that part, but that's interesting.
Yeah. And I don't know if they ever said where the cult was, whether they said it was Kentucky or not, but I mean, it seems feasible, that it could be that.
Yeah, I mean, I like the idea of that, especially if it opens the door to more black-eyed kids, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Do you have one more?
I could talk briefly about Lullaby.
All right. So Lullaby is written by Ray Fox with art by Phil Hester, who has a new book coming out written by Jeff Lemire. The Family Tree is going to be awesome. Everyone should go get it.
Nice.
I think it's from Image. Phil Hester on art. We have Ryan Cody on colors and Charles Pritchett on letters. Tell me about this one. It was interesting for sure.
Yeah, and yeah, beautiful as well.
Yes,
like because Phil Hester is awesome. But yeah, like. I thought it was definitely intriguing and creepy, but basically the idea is that like this kind of like invasive plant species is starting to pop up, and you know, if left kind of to its own devices for long enough, it would release a spore that would kill anybody within like 100-foot radius or something.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is that like it seems to have a supernatural defense system, which is that it like assumes the appearance of actual people.
Yes.
You know, and like we don't get a lot of specifics on that, but you know, like it could just be dead people that it appears as, you know?
Yeah, it's not specifically mentioned. I mean, like, there's one panel where it seems like there's just bodies everywhere, and maybe these plants are growing out of the bodies. But, you know, in that final panel, for example, when the guy goes in the shed and he's talking to the plant, it's just a plant, right? But it looks like his dead kid. So, yeah, maybe it's just some kind of supernatural thing where it just assumes it's got maybe some like psychological link to whatever people are nearby. Which is actually really interesting in terms of a defense mechanism. Cause it's kind of like what a virus would do, right? Like if a virus is 100% deadly, then the virus is going to die out, right? Cause if it kills everything that it infects, how is it going to spread? So that's why, even though there's some viruses that have really high mortality rates, the most successful ones, like the cold or the flu, for example, don't kill the majority of their hosts, because if you do, you can't spread. And I think posing as a loved one is a really interesting element to the whole story. Because then, of course, you don't want to kill it. It looks like your dead kid. Like, would you want to kill that plant? No.
Yeah, I mean, assuming that it's in your mind and it knows that, like, you don't hate your kid and wish that they were dead.
Well, sure. Sure. Yes. And it could be that, like, it just looks like a plant, but maybe it, like, releases something into the air, like some kind of hallucinogen or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah, dude. That's fascinating. Yeah, it's just like it. Like you just trip out and you see the face of somebody that you know you lost or something. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah,
some traumatic loss in your life, and you're like, no. But yeah, like I think that is fascinating idea as far as like self defense. You know, but it does beg the question about like what is you know driving it and. Mm-hmm. I like that answer as like a hypothesis, you know, because mm-hmm. like otherwise it is supernatural in some sense, you know, it's
yeah.
like the plant is intelligent or it's magic or, you know, something along those lines.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's gotta be some kind of mechanism because we see the kid. I mean, we don't see him die, but we can assume that that's what happens based on the final panel. Cause you see him like riding his bike out of the Save-A-Lot or whatever, and finding the plant and touching it and you see the spores release and you assume he's dead. And then at the end, he is the plant. So maybe that goes back to the whole, maybe it grows out of the dead bodies or whatever. I don't know. But yeah, the whole concept is fascinating. This could be like a really cool, I mean, I love Trees, don't get me wrong. Trees the comic. But
Trees is tight.
Don't you get like maybe a similar vibe to that?
In a sense, you know, in terms of generalities, but like there's certainly a lot of distinctions between the two.
Well, for sure. For sure. And the reason it's called Lullaby is, I guess, it won't release spores and kill you if you just sing it lullabies all day long. Which is super creepy, especially if it's, in the shape of your kid.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this one was really interesting. I would love to see this actually as a miniseries.
Yeah, agreed.
So, Joe, make that happen. All right. Anything else on Shock?
I mean, those are the ones that I prepared, but like, I don't know. Like you were talking about kind of comparing it to the first volume,
yeah.
And like, it's been a minute for me since I read the first volume, but I was really struck reading this volume, like how high the quality was across the board, you know,
mm-hmm.
like I thought it was very well done. And especially I was struck by like maybe in this volume more so than the first, like how kind of horror focused a lot of it was, like
yeah.
not everything, but I really feel like horror really got good representation as far as genre in this volume.
Yeah. If I remember correctly, the first volume also had a lot of horror, and I wonder how much of that has to do with maybe Joe picking some of these stories. But I think there's for sure something historically about the horror format or the horror genre fitting in really well with anthology type things, not just books. But, you know, like, you know, even TV shows. Well, I mean, I guess some of those TV shows are based on books anyway, like Tales from the Crypt and things like that. But you got to remember, like, you know, horror anthologies were giant for decades, right? And they kind of got killed by the Comics Code Authority. Shame on those people. But even after the Comics Code Authority came around, there was still a pretty good chunk of books coming out that were kind of this format. You know, like Tales from the Crypt type format, for example. And yes, Tales from the Crypt was one of those books. But it's always done extremely well, and I think maybe that kind of died off. I mean, I would say probably in the 80s when comics changed quite a bit. But, you know, there were these kind of books coming out since the 40s, and they always did extremely well. And there were dozens of these kind of books coming out and on the newsstand. So I'm glad that at least there's some semblance of that still coming out. Because I do love anthologies. I think it's an extremely underutilized format. And, you know, anthologies were big on TV for a couple of years. We'll see if maybe there's some more of that coming out with, you know, like Twilight Zone just finished the first season. So maybe we'll see a resurgence of that based on that show. But like when American Horror Story came out, I mean, there were probably a dozen TV shows of that similar format. The difference is, like, that's not a true anthology, right? Because those are, it's like a story per season. And, you know, you get a new season, you might have the same characters or the same actors, but it's not the same story. And that's not really an anthology. An anthology is exactly what Shock is. Or a book like It Came Out on a Wednesday that Alterna puts out. Or, you know, even like the What If stuff that Marvel was doing and I guess is going to be doing again soon. Those are true anthologies, and it's cool to see that. Yeah, I think the quality was really high in this one. I remember the first volume being extremely high quality, but I do feel like for some reason I related more to these stories, or related more of the stories in the book. I think there was still like other stuff, right? Like there was some fantasy stuff. In this one with, oh man, what was the name of the story? Let me look it up real quick. Gotta go to the index. Ultimus, that was kind of a fantasy story. What was the other one?
Luck of the Draw?
Yes, Luck of the Draw. So there was some of that in there as well, but yeah, a lot of horror. We didn't talk about it because it was very brief. And I think the interpretation could go any number of ways. I know I read it a couple times and I was like, is it this or is it that? I'm Not Afraid, the Jill Thompson story. I thought that was interesting. The girl and her mom and she goes to the woods to scare the kids.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. That was cool. I think that story maybe needed a couple more panels to flesh it out a little bit more, but that was really interesting. I enjoyed that quite a bit. I think Matt Miner had a story similar to that in another anthology book. So yeah, very good.
Yeah, I mean, what I would say is, you know, like, there still are some, you know, anthologies kind of this sort that are, like, on the market, you know?
Yes.
Like, obviously, like, Heavy Metal's still around.
Oh, sure.
And 2000 AD's around, et cetera, et cetera. Like, yeah, they're not as common, but I think that...
if you go on, like, Kickstarter, they're everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I kickstarted a horror anthology called, what's it called? The Cauldron.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's good. But what I would say is, like, this one really, I think, does, like, come with some big names attached, you know? Like, I think that's something that they did really well in both volumes. It's like, oh, you know, like, here's a story by Garth Ennis, you know, here's, like, art by Phil Hester, you know, here's a story by R.L. Stine, you know, like, they definitely bring a lot of name talent that can like generate interest, and hopefully it just helps to, you know, keep the format out there.
Yeah, for sure. So I know it's the book's been out for, what, like 2 months now? Sorry it took so long to get to it, but I'm glad we did. And if you haven't picked it up, pick it up, because it's awesome.
There's just so much, dude. Like, we how long did we spend talking about it?
Yeah, no kidding. And we only talked about, like, 10 pages worth of story.
Yeah.
Yeah, very good. I think that's going to wrap it up, Travis. What do you think?
Nah, let's keep going.
You have been listening to the Aftershock Central podcast. Thank you for having us in your ear holes. I hope your ears didn't catch an infection. They might be itchy, though. Who knows? You can, of course, find us on Twitter at Rumbar316. That's Ronnie. Tell him to quit working so much. Tell him to come record a podcast. You can find Travis at The Great Magnet, also on the illustrious Valiant Central podcast that has the exact intro and outro as this show. And you can find me on, who knows, too many shows. At Geekvine, that's where I'm at. The show is, of course, at Aftershock Pod. Thank you for listening, and we'll catch you next week.